The Coin Week podcast is sponsored by PCGS. Watch an informative video detailing how PCGS has revolutionized the rare coin industry. It's a snapshot of 35 years of numismatic history. Go to www.pcgs.com to learn more. This week on the Coin Week podcast, Chris Bullfinch and I interview Arthur Friedberg, author of Paper Money of the United States and a guidebook of United States paper money. Arthur Friedberg is a talented numismatist and one of the leading experts in U.S. currency. We talk about currency collecting and other topics next in the Coin Week podcast. So hi, Art. Thanks for joining us on the Coin Week podcast, or I guess this week it'll be the Currency Week podcast.
Okay, well, it's good to be with you.
So there's a lot of interesting things that have been developing in recent years when it comes to currency. Of course, you have, you know, the grading of currency, and that has led to new pricing levels, which I'm sure has complicated matters for you as you put out your annual edition of the Paper Money of the United States. And also, we've seen some major currency collections come up for sale in recent years, including the collection of the Joel R. Anderson paper money collection of U.S. Notes, including many of the finest known examples and many million-dollar notes. Mm-hmm. There's also a matter of currency being called into question about what the representation of the notes or the design of the notes. The BEP is constantly evaluating and updating our designs. Although it seems like we never really get a major overall on who's on it. And that looks like it may change with Harriet Tubman. So a lot to talk about. So we wanted to get started and just kind of get in the basics first. So what prompted you to get into currency and to start your research?
Well, this started out many, many years ago before the Second World War, even as a family business, where my dad was just a coin dealer operating out of his apartment in Queens, New York. And then he went off to war, spent part of the war going through villages in Belgium, buying coins and sending them back, and got back after the war and moved full-time into the coin business. And within coins, he also obviously dealt with paper money, which was, in those days, cheaper than dirt. I mean, if you look at the results of the Grinnell sale in 1944, which was still considered today the greatest collection of paper money ever assembled, the prices were nothing. Notes that are selling for hundreds of $1,000s now sold for $140 in the Grinnell sale. So My dad took his business, and then he also decided to start doing a couple of books, one of which was Paper Money of the United States, which is what we're talking about today. And the first edition was back in 1953, and he did something which no one had been able to do before then, and that's publish pictures of United States currency, because it wasn't allowed. Mm-hmm. And somehow he got permission from the Secretary of the Treasury to reproduce the photos as long as they were black and white, which they still should be black and white in my opinion, and as long as they were less than 75% or more than 150% of actual size. So that was the first edition in 1953, and right now we're working on the 22nd, which should be in the middle of this year.
You know, I always kind of look at like the numismatic study, you know, as sort of a forensic science. I mean, we don't often get like the full accounting from the issuing authority of what they're doing. Government reports are notoriously wrong from time to time. Like, how much do you think coming into creating this standard reference was widely known by the numismatic community about the issue of United States currency? Do you think there's quite a bit of mystery that needed to be unraveled before something like this could be put together?
Paper money collecting until the middle of the last century was an ugly stepsister. Paper money collectors were called rag pickers. Mm-hmm. They were looked down upon by coin collectors. And I think one of the reasons that paper money collecting became more popular was as coins became more and more expensive, and for some United States coins became ridiculous, frankly, people realized that there were bargains to be had in paper money, where you could actually trace much easier than coins how many were known, because there's this really odd thing about paper money. Each one has its own unique number.
Right. I mean, do you think us switching to clad coinage and sort of untethering coins from precious metals also might have had an impact for people going back and looking at silver certificates and gold certificates in a new light?
I think that when we went from silver to clad, and then we had the famous June 30th, 1968 deadline, where if you had a silver certificate until, I think it was June 30th, I mean, you can check me on that, if you had a silver certificate up until that date, you could bring it into a bank or into the government, and they would give you a dollar's worth of silver for it. And that created a boom in awareness of paper money, I think, unlike we've had since. And I remember to this day, I mean, flying around the country, picking up silver certificates on the last day, because silver was going up and the notes were trading at a premium.
Right. That was sort of like the 1857 large cent moment, you know, where people were redeeming them for small pennies at that point, because you had to turn them in or you wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, it was great. But, you know, right after that, anyone who was left with silver certificates, you were pretty shot. I mean, some of them are still only worth $1.10.
Right.
But it did create a lot of interest. I think the Red Seals created a lot of interest. And, you know, I remember after 1963, basically, Federal Reserve notes took over. And so when people saw this old money, the Blue Seal silver certificates, the Red Seals, the Brown Seal national bank notes, even though a lot of them aren't worth it, that created a lot of interest in the money. But I'm not quite so sure that the go from silver to clad really had anything to do with it as much as collectors looking for something else to collect. I always thought that the early clad coins and uncirculated would sooner or later be really, really scarce because no one wanted them at the time. I really don't know how that's worked out, although I think some of the early clad coins in top condition are nice, but nothing like silver coins.
Right.
And that's too bad because copper nickel clad's tougher to strike.
Yeah. So you mentioned a few minutes ago that when your father was putting together the book initially back in the 1950s, that he had to go, that he had obtained permission from the Treasury to reproduce images of the notes for the book. Could you elaborate a little bit on why he had to go get that permission? Was it illegal to create images?
It was totally illegal. You'd go to jail. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was basically, it's the counterfeiting statute. And that's why you have to be mystified why back, oh, I don't know how long it was ago, 20 years ago. So all of a sudden they started allowing you to reprint the notes in color. And the story was that a congressman or a government official of some kind who collected paper money decided that he wanted the notes to be in color. And that's why, I don't know if that's a true story or just a fantasy, but in many ways, if you think United States paper money is used all over the world, one thing people don't know is that, for instance, our $100 bill, 65% of them, I think, are not even in this country. They're used overseas. So where people aren't as familiar with the country, why do you make it easier for someone to run them through a copy machine and use them? So I think that was a mistake, but it's good for marketing books, so I'm thrilled that way.
Yeah, somebody who has to deal with graphics on a regular basis. I mean, it's a pain for us because it's difficult to illustrate an article about paper money when Photoshop won't allow you to import the images to do any sort of manipulation on them.
Well, there's a way. I mean, we all run into that, and there are ways around that, which I'll be happy to tell you about sometime, but not on this.
Right. So, you know, one of the things that strikes me, and like I think Art's Paper Money in the United States book is should be a standard reference for any collector, and even if you're not somebody who would routinely specialize in paper money, you should have it. You never know; you could pick something really interesting at your local shop or at a show. But one of the things that strikes me is, you know, when you go through this book, is how ornate and elegant and prolific the government was in designing notes throughout the history of our use of paper money, and how, at least throughout my lifetime, although there's been several iterations of, you know, the $5, $10, $20 bill, $50 bill, $100 bill, there really hasn't been like a real overhaul in what we want these notes to look like. They weren't afraid of doing it early on. You know, you have, you know, a battlefield note, you have the watermelon note, you have all these different notes. And now I guess it's contentious because we're looking at replacing Andrew Jackson on the $20 bill with Harriet Tubman. But do you think that perhaps we're long overdue to rethink all of these notes and maybe redesign the entire series?
You might not have read my article in last week's Coin World. I'm not sure if the print edition is out yet. But we ran a story, which I happened to find in, of all things, Foreign Policy magazine, which makes no sense at all. But basically, what the guy said was U.S. paper money is too static and too conservative. And he basically closed it out by pointing out that the youngest person on our currently circulating money is Ulysses Grant. And he contrasted that with Canada, which, even though they have old white politicians on the front of their notes, on the backsides, they have become very contemporary. And the new five should be really interesting. It'll either be Terry Fox, who did the Race Across Canada for Cancer, or probably a Native American. Even Japan, they used art on the back that you'd never see on this. England, even though the Queen's on one side, they use modern historical figures on the other. So yeah, I mean, our paper money, it's
well, just, even the Queen of England's younger than Ulysses Grant.
That's true. Yeah, not by much, but Grant died in 1885, so take it from there. But I mean, it is, in my opinion, it's crazy, and it hasn't always been this way.
Yeah, but I think we've seen it with our coins, right? It's like we've developed like an imperial coinage where we've sort of turn like these former elected officials into sort of like emperors that remain on coins forever. I mean, it's almost unpolitic to imagine somebody saying it's time to replace Jefferson with something else, because what could live up to Jefferson?
Actually,
what
could live up to Donald Trump did say it was time to replace Jefferson with Jackson on the $2 bill when they wanted to put Tubman on the 20. Trump obviously didn't realize that Jefferson was on a $2 bill. Trump didn't know that we had a $2 bill.
I mean, do you think changing the currency would have a, I mean, I would imagine as collectors, it would have a good impact on the hobby.
It would be the best thing that ever happened to collecting, number one. And number two, it would be the best thing that could happen to the country, because a country's money reflects what it is. And that's part of what this article says. A country's money reflects what it is and what it believes. And this country is not a bunch of ancient white men anymore, nor is it a bunch of old symbols. And we really should be thinking about doing what Secretary Liu proposed back in 2016, and hopefully the new administration will go ahead and will bring us some change to the 5, the 10, and the 20, although we really don't know what order it's going to be. The BEP says the 20 is not supposed to be the first, but rather the last, because their security needs are more for others. But we'll see what happens. Currency design is not subject to congressional approval. It's strictly the domain of the Secretary of the Treasury. Congress has say on coins because it says so in the Constitution. The Constitution doesn't say anything about paper money.
Would you be in favor of like the BEP starting a series of commemorative banknotes?
I would like to see it, but you're not going to see it. It's not going to happen. Okay, and they will say the reason is because the purpose of the money is to facilitate commerce. And United States money is used so much all over the world, unlike a lot of these others, that it would be too confusing. Of course, having said that, the $2 bill, Federal Reserve note from 1976, was essentially a commemorative banknote. They issued it for the purpose of the bicentennial, and that's why they took Trumbull's portrait of the signing of the Declaration of Independence and put it on the back.
Yeah, and people love the $2 bill sort of as a collectible, even though it's not particularly rare. It's just not prevalently used.
I've read stories of people getting arrested trying to spend $2 bills, though, because cashiers don't always believe that they're real. But yeah, no, they're definitely cool notes.
Well, yeah, and you know, there's no drawer for them either in the till.
Right. Well, so
no slot in the till. Excuse me.
Why do you think designs of U.S. paper money have remained static for as long as they have? It seems we've had the basic designs on our paper money, at least the central designs, have remained largely the same since the late 20s. Why do you think that is?
Conservatism. There's no other
aesthetic answer. Or political conservatism, or both.
All of the above. Yeah, I mean, there's no other reason. They could have changed, but they just don't want to. And the Bureau of Engraving and Printing will always tell you, well, the purpose of currency redesign is always security. Yeah, it's always security, but you can build the security around other devices too. I mean, that's a little bit disingenuous on their part, but they're never going to not say it, so we might as well accept it.
So when, you know, as the, you know, we've had 4 years essentially of a continuance of the status quo as far as the Jackson note, but in your research, did you ever like dig into like just how far the BEP got with their redesign of the note?
They will not talk about it.
Sort of put on hold.
I will make conjecture that is totally speculative, that has no basis in any research, interviews, fact or anything, but they were working on it. When they were instructed to stop working on it, they thus stashed it away and didn't destroy it. And I'm pretty sure they just whipped it out and started working on it again. I can't imagine that that's not the case.
I mean, one of the things that like I think about this note that actually kind of makes me concerned about it is that, you know, I think because it's become such a political football that in the eventuality or assumption that it ever does get released, that, you know, I have a feeling that a lot of these notes are going to be mutilated or defaced or whatever. I don't know if, like, you know, the proponents of the design change and putting Tubman on the note realize that, like, you know, they're going to be barreling into conflict whether or not they imagined it or not. I mean, it's gonna happen, and then we're gonna have to have public stories about people like with notes with like egregious public comment scrawled on it.
Well, I believe it's a felony to deface United States currency. Okay, you can take a sticker and put it over the face of it to sell a souvenir, but defacing it is against the law. And if someone wishes to do that, I guess they take their fate into their own hands. So it might happen, but it might not. You know, I'd be more concerned about a $1 bill, which, of course, they cannot change. Congress has mandated that the $1 bill design cannot be changed. To go to war on a $20 bill, that takes a little bit more conviction.
Would it be legal to use a rubber stamp to apply like text in or an ink? An ink design that you stamp onto it, does that count as
defacement? I'm not sure about that. I think you can do that. You're not defacing it. I think you can do
well,
that.
So then I guess that does I guess that would provide an avenue for the people Charles is concerned about to potentially put, as he put it, egregious public comment onto the notes. But I mean, again, my ardent hope is that people don't do that, but it's possible that they would.
But you know what, in every group you'll find a couple of nuts,
right? That's absolutely true.
So, you know, we don't spend our lives worrying about the nuts. We spend our lives worrying about most of the people. And I think most of the people will be fine with it. I mean, they will do a lot of marketing. They will do a lot of explanations. And hopefully it'll be done in good taste, and I'm pretty sure it will. But it's time to get rid of Andrew Jackson for sure.
Do you have any opinions on, like, the use of polymer for banknotes as opposed to the sort of the cloth we use?
The U.S. government swears that the cotton linen, 75-25% that they use, is better than polymer. Polymer is kind of odd. I mean, if you put it in a microwave, it'll get really interesting. People are somehow managing to use the polymer base to change denominations. In certain countries, I mean, in humid climates, polymer makes more sense than paper. But it does have a really, really odd feel to it. And the BEP says they can do as much with counterfeit protection on the cotton linen as they can on polymer. Now, De La Rue would disagree with them. If you look at De La Rue's website this week, they have a new display of their house note where they take all their features and show the things they can do with it. Of course, De La Rue is the biggest polymer manufacturer in the world, so they have a stake in it. But for certain places, I think it works. Some certain countries probably just don't want to use it. I wouldn't say never, but it would be a long time if we ever see it here.
You know, something that like concerns me, I think, about the longevity of coins is like, you know, if you go back to 1857, you know, they eliminate the half cent. And the half cent, I think if you adjust for inflation at that point, probably had a purchasing power of about 11 cents today. And maybe more. And so if you take that as the value of it today, then you essentially today only have the quarter that circulates that had more value than the lowest denomination coin that they got rid of back then because it was valueless. There's no way that the half dollar will ever come back in its current size. And there's no way I think that the dollar coin will circulate because there's a $1 Federal Reserve note and because $1 just isn't valuable anymore to the point where like you'd want to go buy your lunch in coins. Sure. So without introducing maybe a $2.50 or $2 coin or a $5 coin, we're probably only a decade or so away from all U.S. circulating coins being entirely obsolete. And we have we're running into, you know, you have the resistance between the two industries, the minting industry and the paper money industry, supply industry, you know, creating these notes. I don't see anybody ever like on the paper money side being willing to give up the $1 note or the $5 bill and then going to 10, 20, 50, 100, $250 notes.
Yeah. Of course, the other question is with the 100 being the highest note, the 500 today would be the equivalent of what the 100
like
was
in the 80s, yeah,
30 years ago. Yeah. So that makes sense. One about coins. Back when they were developing the euro, and I was working with a lot of European mints at the time, they did a study and they found that no coin will circulate effectively if its diameter is greater than 30 millimeters. And the problem you have with paper vis-a-vis coins is, you would think that the higher denomination, the lower denomination should go to coin, but what kind of coin do you do? And if you've ever spent a lot of time walking around the UK with the pound coin, if you had 5 or 10 pound coins in your pocket, you'd be wearing a hole in your pocket.
Right.
Because they were so heavy. And that's the same thing with the Swiss 5 franc coin that is utterly impossible to use.
So we've just gotten to the point where like, because coins really have no intrinsic value, like worth trading, that coins essentially are just change making counters or tokens. So they'll never be more than that.
They're tax tokens. Coins are tax tokens, essentially. I mean, the 1 cent came into being really because of, for tax purposes. I mean, that's what it was used for the most part in recent times. And the euro countries have basically gotten rid of their 1 and 2 cent coins completely because the way they do their retail pricing, VAT is included, and it's always rounded to the nearest 5 or 10. So there's absolutely no reason for the 1 and 2 cent euro coins. And basically, if you want to get a 1 or 2 cent euro coin from most of these countries now, you better buy the mint set.
Right.
Because they're not making them.
Right. Well, you know, I even contemplate, you know, like, the possibility that, you know, since 1982 or 83, the U.S. Mint hasn't created a 1 cent coin that'll ever wear down to the grade of good because the coins will disintegrate before they actually wear that long.
And, you know, not only does it cost more than a cent to make the cent, now it costs more than 5 cents to make the nickel.
Right. So what do you think about the current, you know, if I think we all agree that the future of coins is probably kind of dire. What do you feel about the future of physical paper money? I mean, in light of the fact that, like, for anti-counterfeiting reasons, most major governments have, like, demonized the use of cash and have refused to issue large denomination notes anymore.
Well, large denomination notes, I mean, that's the reason is pretty obvious. It's against money laundering and tax evasion. What's interesting is with the pandemic, demand for paper is as high now as it's ever been. I mean, everyone's working like crazy. You know what people are doing is they're saving it. And I think paper will always be a store of value. I'm skeptical that it's ever going to go away. People want it. I mean, lots of people don't have access to a bank account all the time. They don't want to use plastic all the time. They like to use cash. And I think there's will be a segment that always will use cash. Part of the reason for the high denomination notes being saved more now is, of course, a lot of banks in Europe are now charging people to put money in the bank. So if you have negative interest rates, you're better off taking the money and putting it in your mattress than put it in the bank. It's worth more to you that way. So I'm skeptical on that. I don't think that it's as dire as people say about money being non-existent. For years, I mean, currency has been a very, very small part of the amount of currency in circulation. Most of the money in circulation is electronic and always has been.
So I think your forecast about the future of paper money is a little bit brighter than some people's forecast about the future of coins or the continued issuance and circulation of coins. How do you think that, assuming that cash remains in common use, where do you see paper money collecting going in the future? Do you think that hobby stands a good chance of expanding, or how do you see it changing?
There will always be collectors. I think the biggest problem that the collecting industry has always faced is the demographics of its collecting base. That, to me, is the biggest danger, getting younger people involved in it. And I'm not going to talk about that. I mean, thousands of people have spent countless hours talking about what it takes to bring new collectors in. The bottom line is, as long as I've been in this business, it hasn't really changed. And the reason it hasn't changed is the collector's life cycle is you start out collecting coins when you're a child. You collect them, coins, paper money, whatever. You collect them until you're a teenager. When you're a teenager, most people find other interests, either sports, some socializing. Then they usually go to college. Then they have a family. And their money is tied up. And finally, when they get to their 50s, there's some disposable income again. And that's when they remember back when they were a kid, gee, I collected coins. I collected paper money. And they start all over again. That's why we've always had the same demographic.
That reminds me of the 30, 40, 50 sort of middle-aged crowd of people who love Marvel movies. It's like you're returning to something you liked. You're returning to an interest or a hobby that engaged you as a kid. How do you feel to return to look backwards a little bit, to look more historically? You mentioned earlier in this interview that collectors of paper money were once referred to pejoratively as rag pickers. When did attitudes about paper money as a collectible begin to shift, and what prompted that shift? You mentioned the redemption of silver certificates in the late 1960s.
You know, I'm too young in this business at my age to know. I would say it really started shifting in the mid-70s when it became more accepted as a means of collecting. Before that, it really was specialized. Now, everyone will do it. I mean, certainly notes have taken their place as expensive as some coins. But I don't think it was before the 70s.
Well, I mean, I think of the Binion $10,000 bill display at his casino. You know, he had a huge silver dollar collection, which were, you know, those were sexy coins. But I mean, he really made that high denomination money, something you wouldn't see very often, especially in quantity, really interesting and attractive to people. I mean, there is sort of an allure to like seeing opulent wealth.
Yeah, well, that was paper money. It was a tourist attraction. I mean, the Binion notes still sell, some of them for over $100,000 each, depending on the condition. I mean, for those that don't know, Binion was a casino owner in Las Vegas who got 100 $10,000 notes, all from the New York Federal Reserve District, and assembled them in a horseshoe to display in his casino. And then there was a family fight of some kind or another, and they had to split it all up. And collectors can still buy them today if they have the money.
Yeah. And it's funny, mentioning the $10,000 notes makes me think it's really obscure. I only ever heard about this because I was researching it for a piece I was writing. But there's a big mural of a $1 bill outside the bursar's office. There used to be outside the bursar's office at MIT, and someone painted over. A bunch of people came. I shouldn't say painted. They used some kind of a covering to turn the $1 bill into a Series 1918 $10,000 Federal Reserve note, which, you know, it was kind of a funny prank, and it also reflects, like Charles said, the kind of fixation on opulent wealth manifested in paper money. But I'm curious, you know, to return to the issue of collecting for a second, how do you feel that paper money of the United States and all of its editions since 1953, how do you feel that paper money of the United States has impacted the hobby? What do you think that book's legacy is?
Well, I'll tell you what people tell me.
Fair enough.
What they tell me is the book made the hobby of paper money collecting. And it feels kind of nice that when you read a website today, they people say you still have to get that book. We try to be honest. We try to be straight. We don't put prices in to make anyone happy. We try to put a proper reflection of the snapshot in time. And we also try to keep adding little sections to the book of more esoteric things. I mean, we added postage envelopes a couple of editions ago. In this next edition, for the first time, we're going to include a section on postal notes, which is another one of the vestiges of the Civil War when there was a shortage of small change and people needed it to make money. And so they were looking for all sorts of ways to satisfy the need for small change that didn't exist because of the coin shortage. So we always try to bring more to it. And we also try to keep it not gouge prices. I mean, people complained a little bit when we had only a hardcover edition because it was too expensive. So now we do two editions, do a hard, a soft. We also do an ebook. If I can make a pitch for the ebook, if you want to look at currency to see what it really looks like, get the ebook, put it on your computer screen, and start increasing the size. And look at the notes. That way you will see things you've never, ever seen before. And the artistry of engraving that goes into these it's something that I still do and it astounds me.
So you also have a very good section in your book detailing and sort of explaining different process errors, the way paper money errors are made and released. Well, did you pay any attention or have any comment on that moon money that was paid for that Del Monte sticker error, purposeful error that was auctioned recently?
Well, the auctioneer estimated at $25,000 to $50,000. And if you're a good auctioneer, you always estimate a little bit low to get people interested. But I don't think anyone anticipated that it would go for that much. And the only reason it could have is because there must have been two people that wanted it. I figured it would be around 100, to be honest, but not more than that. So either someone is very, very lucky or someone is going to be very regretful when they ever try to sell it. And I don't know who the buyer was, but that remains to be seen. I mean, I'm happy for the auctioneer. I'm happy for the consigner.
I mean, are those kind of pop culture errors popular or like common? I mean, do things like this pop up where you have like the convergence of like a commercial product like that, a sticker on a note or some sort of way where
it... I've never heard of anything like that. And there's still dispute about how did it get there? Was it an accident or was it a disgruntled employee who was having a really bad day and he decided to take his lunch and stick part of it on a sheet of notes? We just don't know, but it's certainly interesting. I mean, everyone knows now when you go to the checkout counter, if you have a banana, you don't even have to look. You just punch in 4011. Which I found out the four means it's non-organic.
In terms of world notes, are there a lot of nations throughout the world that do what some small countries do and license certain commercial properties out for their coins? I'm thinking of Niue. I think they have Star Wars coins, and it might not be Niue, but there are Simpsons coins and Star Wars coins that are issued by some of these small.
Basically, look, marketers have agreements with these smaller issuing authorities where they can get the imprimatur of legal tender status on a commemorative coin, which makes it easier to sell because it's a coin, although I would dispute that, and easier to get across borders without paying duty because there's no duty on legal tender coinage, whereas there would be duty on a metal. And that's why where a lot of that comes from. I don't think you're going to see currency issuing authorities going to that extent. They will issue things for their own purposes, but not open up their presses for private marketing opportunities. I'd be shocked if I saw that happen. And first, remember, coins are subsidiary now to paper. Paper has I don't want to say more serious use, a more real world everyday use than a lot of these coins would. And a lot of the coins, I mean, the aspect of it that's interesting is they have a face value of, say, $5, and the country will put a $5 legal tender status on it, but it has $25 or $30 worth of silver. So no one's going to ever go and cash it in for face value unless either they're a nut or they're trying to prove a point, which someone did with one mid-Pacific island a while back.
And it also, you know, it also strikes me that paper doesn't have the same, you can't make the same shapes of paper notes that you can with coins. Like I've seen, you know, again, from some of these small issuing authorities, I've seen coins that are shaped like animals and things like that. And you really couldn't get away with that with paper money.
Oh, don't broadcast this because someone might try.
or you could have an origami.
If it never does, I want credit for it.
I don't want to go there.
So you're from Essex Junction, Vermont. Isn't that the location that Bernie Sanders' mitten knitter is from?
Oh, every farmer's market you see Bernie's mittens.
Right.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And the coat
sold out at Burton's.
Right. It just seems to me like every time I've heard of New England as somebody from the South, it seems like a fantasy land of agrarian America with sophisticated, independent, highly educated people with like different industries that you don't see in America anymore. It's like sort of my idealization of it.
No, it's just like any place else except colder. Hey, we've had 4 days above freezing this week, so it's a good week.
So then, do you think we'll ever see a president from New England? Then let's take the country by storm. Is there something about New England's politics that, like, you know, will break through for the rest of the country?
I don't know. We have town meetings. We're having town meeting day next week. Everyone is supposed to participate in direct democracy and go to the town meeting and cast their votes. We did it.
They don't yell at each other.
We did it absentee, of course. So.
All right. Well, Arthur, I appreciate you taking your time today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for asking me. It's been fun.
All right. Take care. Have a good one.
Okay, guys. Thanks.
Thank you.
See you.
If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends. Remember, you can download every episode of the Coin Week podcast for free on the iTunes Store. Stream it online on our YouTube channel or on coinweek.com. For Coin Week, I'm Editor Charles Morgan. Until next time, happy collecting.